So I'm going to talk to you today about sort of ongoing research and some very new results for a project where we're using archaeogenomics to focus on the evolution, natural history, ultimately the domestication of wild cucurbita, the progenitor of squashes and gourds. And by archaeogenomics, I'm referring to genome-scale recovery, sequencing, and analysis of ancient DNA from archaeological contexts, and using that in conjunction with ecological principles, the archaeological record, computational genomics, and other tools to really sort of reconstruct a holistic picture of what's going on in the world of cucurbita, going all the way back into the Pleistocene. There we are. So this is wild cucurbita. There's 14 or so extant species spread throughout the Americas. And this is sort of a typical fruit form. It's anatomically a peepo. It's an indehiscent fruit. It's quite tough. It's impermeable to water and most anything else. Cucurbitaceous plants are well known for being very adept at long-distance dispersal on oceanic currents and river systems and flooding events. And they're also extremely well adapted for dispersal by the megafauna, by large mammals. And in fact, we have evidence for this very behavior associated with cucurbita in the New World. We have several Pleistocene dung deposits from mastodons and sites in Florida dating back to about 30,000 years before the present, and sure enough, they are full of cucurbita seeds. So megafauna, particularly New World Pleistocene megafauna, really did seem to be instrumental in the dispersal strategy of these fruits. But all of the megafaunal herbivores in the Americas went extinct, moving into the Holocene, and so that left cucurbita without their naturally evolved dispersal mutualists. This put them squarely in the category of, of ecological anachronisms. This was a term coined by Janton and Martin in the early 1980s in a science paper, used to describe a plant that's really removed temporally from its co-evolved dispersal partner by virtue of extinction events or other sorts of ecological shifts. The New World is absolutely packed full of these anachronistic species. A few examples here: avocado, cacao, horse apple, or Osage orange on the bottom left, and honey locust on the bottom right. These share a few characteristics. One is that they're kind of, they've been described as by Connie Barlow as sort of overbuilt species. They really seem like anatomical overkill for the ecological niches that they're occupying today. It seems like they're a remnant of something in the past. Another hallmark of these is that they carry a pretty serious arsenal of both chemical and physical defenses. For example, avocados, several parts of those, have some moderately toxic alkaloids. Cacao is chock full of alkaloids. It's part of what makes it attractive to us. The Osage orange has some nasty milky saps, and of course, there are these physical armaments that are very much a deterrent to smaller mammals, although they might not be as effective as warding off the actual dispersal mutualists upon which these plants relied during the Pleistocene. So, wild populations of cucurbita seem like they have probably declined in the Holocene. This is a map compiled by Gail Fritz for a... Sorry?
Could you use the microphone?
Yeah, of course. Sorry, is that better?
Yes.
Cool. I tend to move around a bit, so... So these are some archaeological sites compiled by Gail Fritz, sort of illustrating the range of cucurbita use prehistorically, and I added just a few to those, the Morton Shell Mound site, the Delta and Bilbo sites, to sort of illustrate the coastal range as well. And so some of this is probably culturally mediated, some of this range, especially these high latitude sites up at Sherrow and possibly Memorial Park. But since we do find sort of wild type and weedy seeds throughout much of this range, and certainly along the coast, we might expect that this was in some ways illustrative of the ancient range of wild cucurbita, whereas now these things in the eastern woodlands are really sort of relegated to these refugial patches, these sort of relict populations that seem like they represent what's left of a once much larger contiguous population. Another example is a variant of cucurbita peepo, a subspecies peepo, which is a prolific group of cultivars. This originated, we know archaeologically, in southern Mexico around 10,000 years before the present, but we don't have any evidence that this crop exists in the wild in that region now. So it seems like there was a population collapse in southern Mexico. Cucurbita moschata is another example. This is butternut squashes and hundreds of other cultivars. That's an extremely diverse and prolific crop plant, but it's completely unknown in the wild. It's presumed to have come from the New World lowland tropics, but that's about all we know about it. So for whatever reason, cucurbita has seemingly declined in the wild, and we want to sort of test the possibility that this anachronistic bearing, this fact that the natural dispersers are all gone, contributed to that. And so let's look anatomically just for a moment. We do know that cucurbita carries some of these defenses that ward off smaller animals and alternative dispersers. They carry a tough rind that's really quite impermeable, as I mentioned, and they also synthesize some of the most bitter compounds known in nature, cucurbitacins. These are really, really strongly bitter to smaller mammals, and they're moderately toxic. And by that I mean livestock who are desperate and forced to eat wild gourds have approached lethal dose and have actually surpassed lethal dose. And there are a few documented cases of humans dying from cucurbitacin toxicity, although it's quite rare. They don't seem to pose any problem for large herbivores. We know from the mastodon cases, and we also know from elephants dispersing cucurbitaceous plants that they seem to be fine with it, but they are likely unpalatable to extant New World mammals. So it seems like there might be something associated with body size. So on the other side, while these plants are declining in the wild, possibly from some combination of ecological events, including dispersal extinction, we see their absolute thriving in domestic relationships with humans. There's at least six known domestic sort of major lineages of cucurbita. Here are just a few examples, and I won't get into the sort of the nitty-gritty, the taxonomy here, because I'm trying to focus a little more on the group as a whole, and we don't need to worry with that. Suffice it to say that these things have done very well in cultivated relationships with humans, and they've been bred for a tremendous range of phenotypic variability. They probably started as things like container crops and fish net floats. This has been detailed by various researchers, but because they're so bitter and because they're so tough, they wouldn't necessarily have been an attractive food crop until some more genetic levels of domestication had taken place. So to test, we kind of wanted to go into this to test the decline of the wild populations simultaneously with trying to understand from an archaeogenomic perspective the emergence of these domestic lineages in order to try and sort of paint a holistic picture of what's going on. So the first part is focusing on the sensory ecology and specifically testing this cucurbitacin bitterness, this chemical defense, as a particular part of a megafaunal dispersal strategy. So the specific hypothesis going into this is that smaller mammals are actually much more perceptive of bitter-tasting compounds, making them unsuitable cucurbita dispersers. And the reason for this hypothesis has to do with the fact that physiologically, a small mammal needs to be able to detect these environmental detoxins much more acutely than a very large one. So to test this, we took 42 published mammal genomes, basically all the placental mammal genomes of decent quality, and we screened them for bitter-tasting genes in order to sort of reconstruct sensory ecology across all the mammals we could. These were across a range of ecological types and forms, just a small sampling of which you see here. So what we were screening for are these TAS2R genes. We'll call them tasters. They're a family of bitter taste receptors, and they have variable copy numbers between different species, with more copies indicating a greater breadth of bitter taste perception. Humans have 25, and if you have any particular aversion to black coffee, for example, you have a taster gene to thank for that. We found 834 intact taster genes across these 42 species, and we were able to sort of start analyzing the patterns that we found there. They range from 4 copies in a two-toed sloth to 44 copies in a common shrew. So again, revisiting the hypothesis that body size tracks in some way the ability to taste bitter compounds, we can plot the bitter-tasting acuity on the y-axis along with body size on the x, and we do find a quite significant negative correlation between body size and bitter-tasting acuity. Then if we take each of those 42 species and we give them a variable indicating diet breadth, so with between 1 and 4, with 1 indicating an extremely broad spectrum generalist, a mouse, a rat, a chimpanzee, a human could be called a 1, and 4 indicating a specialist, something like a polar bear, a giant panda, a sloth, these very highly specialized things. And we might predict that more specialized animals have less developed bitter tasting abilities by virtue of the fact that they're not sampling so much of the environment. They don't need to detect all these toxins. And when we plot that out, we find a really quite strong correlation between bitter tasting acuity and diet breadth. So what this comes down to is that small generalists, sort of extreme examples being a shrew or a mouse, are really, really good at tasting bitter compounds, whereas large specialists, something like a polar bear or a manatee, sloth isn't quite as large, but it's an extreme case, are not so good at tasting it. The implications of this for cucurbita dispersal are that it really might have been in trouble when the megafauna went extinct in the New World, because most of what was left were not highly specialized and they weren't very big, which means they were probably quite good at tasting bitter compounds. So that's sort of, we'll leave the sensory ecology bit for the moment, and we'll get into to sort of trying to understand the phylogenetic patterning of some of these domestic lineages using archaeogenomics, using ancient DNA. So what we did was we sequenced whole plastid genomes in 85 specimens across taxonomic and temporal and geographic breadth to the degree that we could. 13 of these were ancient from the sites shown on the map, 5 from the Ozark shelters, 7 from Mexico, and 1 sample from Phillips Spring. And 72 were modern to sort of provide the context and the baseline information that we need to start reconstructing phylogenetic patterns. Pardon me. With these data, of course, on the right is our clean lab facility. This is working with ancient DNA. It's critical to observe contamination protocols and to sort of work within the stringency bounds that are required to recover and analyze ancient DNA in a contamination-free context. So we were able to reconstruct these complete plastid genomes and rebuild a quite high-resolution tree across the entire genus. And we're not going to look at this as a whole. We're going to zoom into a couple of different species, Cucurbita pipo and Cucurbita moschata, which is where we focused a lot of our sequencing, and this is where a lot of the economic value of the species exists. So Cucurbita pipo, this breaks down into 3 well-supported groups that are classified formally as subspecies, and we found support for that. Cucurbita pipo subspecies pipo, this bottom group here, that's one that I mentioned was from southern Mexico beginning around 10,000 years before the present. It's completely gone from the wild now, as far as we know. Subspecies Fraterna, the one in the middle, that's a punctually endemic form from around Tamaulipas, Mexico. It's not known in a tremendous volume of populations, but there's a few wild populations out there. And Cucurbita pipo subspecies Ovifera contains several things. It contains a cultivar group, including things like scallop squashes and acorn squashes. It contains Eastern North American wild types in the present, and it also contains ancient Eastern North American archaeological gourds. So a couple of things I want to draw your attention to here is that the origins of the Ovifera lineage have been debated. They have been alternatively suggested to be Eastern North American, sort of native, as part of that local crop complex, or they've been suggested to be introduced from northeastern Mexico. And we find quite strong evidence here that the Eastern North American wild types, the modern wild types, as well as the archaeological types, are all grouping with that Ovifera lineage, which does provide strong support for that native domestication event, which has been indicated archaeologically. Beyond that, we find there's an archaeological example. By the way, I didn't mention the red tips on this tree are the ancient ones. I should have made that clear much earlier. There is an archaeological example of Cucurbita pipo subspecies Fraterna from northeastern Mexico, from a place called Romero's Cave. This appears to be a domestic in morphology. It's got some domestic characteristics. I don't have a photo. I wish I did. But suffice it to say that it seems like there's this domestic form that's just completely dropped out of modern domestic germplasm, possibly an incipient domestic form. Also, in eastern North America, we have these 5 sites in the Ozarks, which form a sort of marginally well-supported subgroup. These guys right here. And what that's indicating, and there's some variation in that that we don't see in modern domestic forms, again showing that there were some lineages that were being brought into domestication and that seemed to have been sort of being culled or were dropped out ultimately between prehistory and the time when we have these modern prolific cultivars being grown commercially. Now let's take one quick look at Cucurbita moschata, and Most of these are pretty invariant, and you can't tell them apart using the plastid genome. It just doesn't have the resolution. Pardon. However, there are two additional long branches on this tree, this Cucurbita moschata tree, indicating a substantial level of genetic differentiation. One example from Romero's cave in northeastern Mexico, and another example from a couple modern cultivars. What this suggests, and we don't have the resolution with these data precisely, and we also, this is not a calibrated tree, so we can't put a molecular clock on estimate on this in the state it's currently in, but what this might suggest is that Cucurbita moschata domestication was a fairly broad-scale thing. Might not have drawn on a single founder population. We might be looking at a situation where sort of Cucurbita moschata, which is unknown in the wild today, was broadly distributed throughout the lowland neotropics, and it was being sort of picked up and used opportunistically throughout much of its range. Then as the wild populations dropped out, some of those plants ended up forming really full-scale domestic relationships with humans. Some of those lineages made it to the present, others did not, as the case with the Romero's cave example. So just to kind of summarize a working model for Cucurbita based on all this information, I would argue that domestication was a widespread phenomenon. We know that because there were six or more independent domestic lineages, probably, as the case with Cucurbita moschata, I'm hoping illustrates. Even within some of these individual species, it was a geographically and temporally widespread and culturally widespread process, the emergence of these domestic forms. I would argue that domestication, colonizing the human landscape, was an adaptive strategy for what was fundamentally an anachronistic species on the decline. And so rind softening and bitter chemical suppression during domestication was ultimately an evolutionary advantage as these gourds were going into a symbiotic relationship with humans. And just to conclude, I'd like to bring up an idea we've just been talking about in the last couple of days, having to do with reproductive isolation of domestic plants. Domestic plants don't need to be reproductively isolated to be successful, but it can really help in terms of the fixation of the alleles and the phenotypes associated with a domestic form or a form that's attractive to humans. With Cucurbita, it would have been really essential to reproductively isolate these domestic populations so that you didn't have the gene flow from wild plants reintroducing constantly the bitterness and the hard rinds that would have made them sort of inaccessible foodstuffs. There are historic accounts of people planting wild gourd plants near the fields of enemies to cross-pollinate and make all their fruits unpalatable, illustrating sort of the transferability of these genes. So in many cases, wheats in the Levant, for example, and to some degree maize in Central America, this reproductive isolation is based on cultural activity. It's humans who have to carry these plants away from their native range. In this case, we might be dealing with a situation where an incipient cultivation relationship begins, and then the wild type drops away as wild populations collapse. So it could be that the wild population declines, which we would argue have something to do with their dispersal anachronism, might have actually strengthened the selection pressures and led to the fixation in some way of these domestication alleles and phenotypes. Just a new idea, and I'd be happy to talk that out with anybody afterward. I'd like to acknowledge a few funding organizations and a few individuals for sample materials and a few organizations, and I thank you very much for your time.